Ed, thank you so much for joining us today on the Ops Drop. Ed, you've been in engineering for about 2 decades now, and you've been an engineering leader at places like Chewy and United Natural Foods, and you are currently building your own business while also consulting, which is super, super exciting. So yeah, thank you for coming on. Welcome to the Ops Drop. We're happy to have you.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So, Ed, before we dive into all the interesting topics that we have lined up, can you tell us a bit about your background, even before you got into engineering and sort of how that shaped you and, how you're seeing other engineers come into the workforce as well and like what their backgrounds are?
Yeah, sure. So my background is not in computer science. I studied journalism. In school and became an engineer completely by accident. So I answered a want ad for an editor at a library in Boston. And it turned out what they wanted was like a data editor, somebody who would scan stuff in and clean up the information. And I was like, well, this isn't good use of my journalism degree. So I got really bored and figured out how to automate my job. Like I just started poking around.
Was automation like even a word at this point? I'm like imagining what automation was looking like with this particular job at the library.
So this was so I don't know if you guys know what Word Perfect is, but it takes you back, right? And so I was using Word Perfect for DOS and they had their own macro language, and there was just a big manual like that was sitting above my cubicle. And so I just took it down and started reading through it. And I was like, oh, like I can just make like simple replacements, like mistakes that I see over and over again in this data, like all the things that I'm doing like in a repetitive fashion, and just run this macro language program. So that's what I did. It was super slow at first. So I had this really, it was like a 33 megahertz computer. And so I'd run the program and it would take most of the day. So I'd like go out and wander around Boston and smoke my cigarettes and get a sandwich. Then they got brand new Pentium computers. And I would run the program and it would take like 30 seconds. So I was like, well, I can just get a lot more done now. So I ended up finishing the whole project something like a year and a half ahead of schedule. So then they were like, well, we don't know what to do with you, but you obviously got some talent, so we're going to make you the website administrator. And so that's what they did. And started learning how to code in Perl. And that was how my whole career was launched.
That's incredible. And I'm curious to hear, Ed, a little bit about you took a little bit of like a winding journey to get into engineering, but I think what we're seeing from the folks coming into the workforce now that a lot of them are coming directly from like getting an education in computer programming and then going straight to the workforce. And I'm curious if like that's if you're seeing differences in folks that have sort of taken that winding journey and maybe came from, you came from journalism. We're talking about you're like there are tons of jazz guitarists that have become engineers now, right? And I'm curious what your thoughts are on, the people that have taken that winding route versus folks that have jumped straight from, being a comp sci major right into, working at a tech company.
Yeah, so there's major differences over the past couple of years. So during the pandemic and prior to the pandemic too, there were a lot of people who took that sort of meandering path into engineering. And then there was a huge drop off in the amount of engineers that were being hired. So what happened was companies got a lot more particular about who they hired. And so they really started looking for those degrees. So people who took non-traditional routes like into engineering, getting fewer and fewer job offers at this point. I mean, even some people with comp sci degrees are struggling to find jobs. just because there was really a glut of hiring, and now there's just a ton of engineers who are on the market, and there's just not enough jobs to fill that. So, yeah, I find it really sad that people are overlooking some of the non-traditional candidates, especially since there's lots of folks who couldn't afford to go to college, went to less expensive colleges, and are still great engineers. Honestly, the best engineer I ever worked with has no degree at all. Never went to college, is completely self-taught, but is absolutely brilliant. And I think there's a lot of folks out there like that, and I think that talent gets overlooked now.
So if you're going and doing some hiring yourself, Ed, knowing that you had like a non-traditional path, you see some value in it from having like the top candidates you've worked with having a non-traditional path. If you were to give, advice to startups or mature companies who are looking to hire engineers around what to look for to make sure that you find the best engineering candidate for the role, what would you say to look for?
So really what you're looking for is the ability for them to add to your culture, and the ability for them to do the job. Right. So, and you can test for those two things. I advise them to not look at a lot of the traditional signals. So I would tell them, like years of experience isn't particularly predictive. Like the college that somebody attended isn't particularly predictive, so ignore those things. And this is partly my experience, right, as an engineering leader for many years, but it's also based on some really hard research. People have been looking at the selection of personnel for over 100 years, and so there's 100 years worth of research into what's predictive of success in a role and what's not predictive. And they found really no correlation between the school that you went to, the amount of education you have, and your success in the job. So really focusing on the two core things that make somebody successful, which is behavioral analysis. So doing some sort of behavioral interviewing to see do they have the soft skills that they need? Can they communicate? Are they motivated? Like how are they going to fit into your culture, and how are they going to add to that culture? That's going to be the big part. And then, an assessment to see can they do the job, right? So, and this isn't, your typical LEET code style questions where you're asking somebody basically to solve a puzzle. Like this is asking them to do something they would actually do in the job, right? Like those are the two things that are the biggest predictors of success. And again, that's not just, me and my experience. That's lots and lots of research that backs that up.
Previously the three of us were talking about before we started recording and whatnot about outsourcing versus having engineers like in-house. And, I'm a firm believer that there's a really fine line between how much art and science it is in engineering. I think there's a lot more art than people assume with engineering. I don't think it's as technical as the average person thinks. I think there's a lot more of a design aspect that most people don't realize. How does that impact the company by outsourcing versus doing it in-house? And what are like the pros and cons of making those decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there really is like to me a clear dividing line between these two things. The folks that you have in-house, like you really want to have creative individuals. Right? You want somebody who can be part of a team, like who can solve problems in creative ways. If you're outsourcing, right, you want somebody who's going to do a well-defined job. You don't get the amount of time with them. And you don't get the amount of motivation with them that you would with somebody in-house, right? So, the projects that I've run that require somebody to like come up with interesting and novel solutions, if I outsource that, they would typically not go well. I would need to have people like inside the organization working together as a team to figure out like what it is they're going to do and how they're going to go forward. The only projects I did outsourced that were successful were the ones where we had a perfectly clear idea of what it was we wanted, and we just needed somebody to execute on it. So, Yeah, there's a ton of art that goes into this, and that art is really best done in-house. And if you just need somebody to just crank out some code and build the thing that you've already designed, outsourcing is totally fine.
That's really interesting, and I've seen that same exact thing play out at multiple different companies, regardless of stage, industry, whatever. And I'm curious to hear about your perspective from like historically, right? We've sort of seen this flux in this exact trend, right? There's like, a globalization of talent. Okay, we're gonna outsource a ton, and that's gonna be a whole part of our business. And then pulling back, now we're just gonna be in-house, right? And I feel like that's been sort of a wavy trend throughout history. And I know you are a data guy, so I'm curious to hear, if you've done any research on this, or even just in your past experience, like how are you seeing that fluctuating?
Yeah, so I don't really know that there's any research on this, but certainly in my experience, there's essentially fashion trends that leaders follow.
Yeah.
If all the cool kids are outsourcing, then you want to get on that outsourcing trend, right? Like the news you're reading, the articles you're reading, conferences you go to are all about, like this outsourcing trend and about how great it is and all of these successes. So people hear that, they internalize it, and then they're like, we're going to go do this. And then somebody says, hey, this isn't working out for me. Like, let me try something else. Right. That creates this new trend. And so you see people following these trends, trying to figure out what works best. And often it's really just a fashion, right?
Yeah.
It's not something that's based on data. It's not something that's necessarily going to work. It could even be something that you've done previously that didn't work, but now it's kind of, like trendy again. So you're going to try this
Get
all
out of
over.
that loop though. Like I'm like, how do we unlearn this behavior where we stop? We see the same, Darren and I see the same thing in ops. It's like decentralized operations, everybody has their own operator, then centralize it again, then decentralize it, and it's like, how do we not make it this fashionable trend and go one way or the other? I don't know. Like, how do we unlearn this and get out of the cycle?
Yeah, it's really hard, especially when you have turnover at higher leadership levels. So when you have a VP or a CTO that's coming in, and like they want to make their mark on an organization, they're going to change whatever is there. It's just kind of it's like a foregone conclusion. I've never worked at a place where leadership turned over and they're like, no, everything's great. Let's just keep going the way we're going. Right. Inevitably, like they're coming in, they're like, I have to fix everything. So I think there's a lot of human emotion that's part of this. Right. So, like they're worried that they're going to miss out on a really important trend. They're worried that they're not going to be seen as valuable if they're just sort of continuing with the status quo. I don't know that like we can just say, hey, let's look at the data. Let's be rational about this, because there's always going to be a part of work that's irrational, right? Like we're still human beings, right? CTOs are human beings, just like the rest of us, and they're going to make decisions based on emotion, at some frequency. The more data you can bring to it, the better. But inevitably, like we can't escape the fact that we're humans.
Something that I've thought about, Ed, is in revenue operations specifically. I've noticed when people are decentralizing or centralizing, like marketing ops, CX ops, or sales ops, I feel like a lot of times it's due to the people who are in the leadership roles within those departments wanting full control. And it's like a matter of saying, hey, yeah, I want control of this, and that's why it's here. Do you think that like the in-house versus the outsourcing is a similar motion, or do you think it's more of a skill related motivator to say, hey, listen, somebody may not understand or have the full scope of how to develop that product with an outsourced team, so it's safer for them to do it in-house because they can have more of a design aspect with the team?
Yeah, I think it's there's lots of different drivers for this behavior. So I've seen people who want control, or people who believe that their headcount is an indicator of how important they are. I've seen people who just want to cut costs, right? So they move stuff offshore. And sometimes there's good reasons for that. If the organization is struggling, cutting costs can make sense up to a point. Like if you're now producing poor quality code, or you're not producing the features that you need to, well, you've kind of shot yourself in the foot. But yeah, it's not, at least in my experience, it's not one thing. There's a whole different, there's a raft of different reasons why somebody is going to choose in-house versus outsourced.
So, when you brought something up just now that, made me realize, a lot of these leaders are making that decision due to costs. They're saying, hey, listen, we need to outsource because we need to cut budgets. If you were to hire somebody in-house, you need to like vastly prove a much better ROI for that individual or the value for that individual. What are some things that if somebody's hiring internally when they're getting a lot of pressure to hire outsourcing, because they do believe that there's the value in hiring in-house. What are some of the things that they can look at and highlight in the value to kind of show the benefit of having somebody in-house?
Yeah, I think the strongest predictor for needing somebody in-house is going to be the quality of your product organization. So if you've got a fantastic product organization that can really define these projects, they really understand like what needs to happen, and they can work well with an outsourced team, like working asynchronously, especially if you're working with a team, say in India. Which is really difficult because you've got an 11 and a half hour like time difference. So there's very little overlap where you're sitting together in a room. You need to have like clearly documented evidence for why this is important. You need to understand what they're going to do, and you need to be able to hand it off to them asynchronously. So if you have that, then outsourcing is fine. Right? You can get by with that. If you don't have that, what you're going to end up with is really just churn, right? You're going to continue to produce code, but you're not going to produce the features that users really want and need. And if you're not doing that, then you're not driving revenue. You're frustrating people. Again, you've shot yourself in the foot, really.
Yeah, I want to pull on that thread a little bit more, Ed, because I want to talk about what a good engineering org actually looks like. Like what a healthy engineering organization looks like, because I see a lot of engineering leaders struggling to articulate a very clear value and impact around what their team is doing. And I'll give you an exact example. I was speaking with an engineering leader recently, and or it was product or engineering or both. And they were saying it's hard to articulate the value of a platform team, right? That makes sure like everything is the uptime is good, everything's safe, secure, whatever. And they're like, it's very hard to tie that to revenue. And I was like, is it? Because I'm thinking about my fiance is a sales engineer, and she spends all day ripping through RFPs. And if you want to land a big enterprise client, you better have a safe and secure platform that is up all the time. So I'm like, why couldn't you make that correlation? And it was sort of like the light went off in their head a bit. And I'm not saying it's because I'm particularly smart. It's just because I come from go-to-market and I know what's happening and I know how, a good platform can help you win deals. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on like, what does a healthy, impactful organization look like? And like, what data can an engineering leader look at and showcase to share that?
Yeah, so for e-commerce operations, like when I was at Chewy, we had a metric of revenue per minute, right? So during peak times, like Black Friday, say, we would have tens of thousands of dollars of revenue flowing through our systems per minute, right? So if we had downtime, Like there was a clear impact on our revenue.
Really interesting. Okay.
So, like we and we knew that fluctuated. So like we were able to track that revenue was at any point in time. So, slow times like during the summer, you might see $2,000 per minute. Peak times, you would get up to $10,000 per minute. So we actually had this was born from somebody's idea when we had an outage on Black Friday. That wasn't my fault. Just to be clear, Amazon went down. One of their services was no longer working, but our platform was so brittle that, we couldn't survive something like that. So our whole platform was out at Chewy. We lost hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, because we couldn't get the site back on time, back up. So going forward, it was really clear to people that we needed to have a platform that was not brittle, that could survive outages from Amazon, like external things. And so we were able to clearly demonstrate like why it was important. So for an e-commerce operation, I think it's pretty easy. For say like a small SaaS company that's only operating, 9 to 5 or 8 to 8 or whatever it happens to be, it's a lot harder to justify. So it's, revenue per minute is great for a large e-commerce company or other companies. I think you're gonna struggle because downtime is more tolerated in some industries than in others.
You mentioned the understanding of the alignment of the go-to-market metrics with like revenue being one of those key factors. If you're working with an engineering organization and they don't really have a view of what to look at, where should they look to partner right out the gate to have somebody focus on some of those metrics to help drive those outputs? Is it product operations, go-to-market, RevOps?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's everybody, right? A good engineering leader is going to be part of a team. Like that's going to include all of those folks. In smaller organizations, you're really going to start with product. Product is then going to talk to RevOps. But ideally, you've got everybody in a room together. And you understand how they impact one another. You can't have a healthy organization without all of those people talking to one another. And I really believe just getting everybody together in sort of this, in this weekly scrum of ideas is the best way to get this done. Most places don't do it like that. Most places there's, this clear define between engineering and business, right? And there's this, Chinese wall in between those two, and you kind of lob things over the wall and you sort of hope that the impact gets understood. Usually you're lobbing it over the wall to product. Product then goes and interacts with everybody else. But yeah, there's, like you, if you have an e-commerce site, you don't have a business without a website, right? And so, like if you're really committed making sure that your customers have what they need, you have to include engineering in that discussion.
Revenue operations were like it was a big trend, and people are buying into it and starting to onboard onto moving things from a sales, CX, and marketing ops down to a revenue operation structure. The big motivating factor for that was to like remove silos between departments. So like everyone's marching to the same beat of the drum, and everyone's focused on the same metrics, and we're moving as like a go-to-market unit. You brought up product. In your world, when you're thinking engineering for like the optimum organizational structure, do you feel like product and engineering should sit in the same place? How should they interact? And what would that optimum, organizational structure look like on that end of the company?
Yeah, so product managers like should be embedded in an engineering team. Right? Like they're critical to what engineers are doing on a daily basis. They're going to bring the why of what's going on, and engineers need to know this on a regular basis, right? So, what and why really lives with product, and then who, I guess, and then everything else belongs to engineering, right? Like the how is going to belong to engineering. If you have a product manager that's disconnected from that team or supporting two or three or 10 teams or whatever it's going to be, they're not going to be able to be there to be immersed in that product to figure out like what is really important to help drive the engineering organization. And just on a very tactical level, they're not there to answer questions, right? So you're leaving a lot of decisions up to engineers if you don't have that product person embedded in the team, which is fine in some circumstances. In other circumstances, you don't really want engineers making decisions that are going to dramatically affect the product.
Yeah, there's a lot of those like meme sort of diagrams of like what the customer, what the product manager, said to do, what the designer designed, what the engineers built, and then what the customer actually wanted. And the delta is pretty massive. And one question I have for you too is like we're talking a lot about, the engineering experience, right? The onboarding and how they work with the team. And one thing stood out to me that you said when we first spoke, which is like people see engineering as the giant magical machine in the basement. And I have absolutely been a part of that, like, I don't know what you want to call it, group of people that thinks and feels that way, which is weird, right? Because like I've been working in product for years now, and I've been at organizations where I've been in senior leadership on product and not even interacted with many engineers, right? And it's sort of like engineers amongst every part of the business is like seen as data points, which is very strange because they're building the product. They're arguably one of the most important functions. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on like how we can get away from that line of thinking. Yeah, if you have any points of view on that.
Yeah, so I was the head of engineering at a small firm, and what we did was we brought everybody together in a room, right, to really understand like what it was we were trying to do, right? So I helped build out OKRs for the entire organization, right? And like we really tried to do them right, right? We started out with like two, three objectives for the entire company. And then we talked about how each department was going to contribute to those overall objectives, right? And so then we filtered that down to like individual goals for engineers, right? So my engineers could trace their responsibilities, their day-to-day responsibilities, all the way up to the objectives for the company, right? And when you have that, like when you have people who are working together to achieve a common objective, you've got a far more healthy team. Right? You have everybody like working together cohesively because they all understand why it is they're doing what they're doing. It's very rare that I have seen this in organizations. Some of the places I've worked, I won't name them, but they would have OKRs for each individual silo that they had, right? So I was working in engineering. They had OKRs for engineering, and then they had OKRs for product, and they had OKRs for design, and none of them connected to one another, right? They were all doing their own thing in their own silo, but we couldn't do anything without one another, right? Designers can design everything they want, but if engineers aren't building it, like it's completely irrelevant, right? Product can say, here's what we need for the customers. If design isn't designing what they need for the customers, it's all irrelevant, right? Like these three things are so critical to one another. And then you bring in RevOps, right? Like if you're marketing something that we haven't built, and trust me, this has happened. Marketing and sales has come to me and said, "Hey, we just sold the thing. And we know it doesn't exist. Can you build that and get it done by Monday?" Right, like these are the sorts of things that happen when you don't have everybody working together as a team.
I love that. Ed, we've loved chatting with you today. Before we wrap, I have a couple questions for you. One, if you were to pick like the top three things any engineering organization should be like having at the top of their mind this year, what would those three things be?
One, I mean, because it's near and dear to my heart, right? It's sort of hiring and onboarding, which to me are, like parts of the same thing, right? You really need to think about how you're bringing people into your organization, and be deliberate about it. It's sort of a self-serving pitch for me, but like that's I do believe that that's critically important. The second is figuring out how to work together as a team to achieve what you're going to be doing. Teams are a lot slimmer now. Like folks are relying heavily on AI to get stuff done, which is probably a mistake. I would say you need to be cautious about that. And then finally, let me think of a third thing. I guess, in combination with the second thing, stop relying so heavily on AI, right? In concert with all the stuff that I've talked about today, right? You need to think about engineers as problem solvers, as creative problem solvers. AI doesn't help you creatively solve problems. AI statistically predicts what the most likely solution to a problem is, and that's not necessarily what you want, right? You want new and innovative solutions to things. You want to see things in different ways. And you need to treat engineers like people, creative people who are there to help you solve problems, not people who are just cranking out code.
That's some wonderful advice. L last question for you. If people want to get in contact with you, how can they get in touch with you?
The website is GordianKnot.company. You can just Google Gordian Knot Hiring and you should find me. And it's KNOT, not NOT. Although I do own both domain names just in case.
Okay.
I think that's the best way to get in touch with me. If we want to include some information, maybe in the comments or the description, with an email address or a Calendly link, that would be great too.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy to do that. Thanks again for coming on.
Yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. It's been my absolute pleasure. Love talking with you guys about this. Love talking about this in general. So, anytime you want to have me on, I'm more than happy to come back.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, guys.